This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello everybody, and welcome to a History of Egypt podcast interview. My guest today is Dr. Brianna Jackson. Brianna Jackson is a recent graduate from the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University. Her research focuses on Atenism, specifically the many temples that Akhenaten commissioned. As you can imagine, this overlaps quite nicely with our recent episodes. So I sat down with Dr. Jackson to discuss her work and her new qualification. Brianna completed her PhD in May 2021 with a thesis titled The Geographic and Social Spread of the Aten Cult Through Egypt and Sudan, and her PhD was just awarded at the time we are speaking. So, we have a new discussion with a brand new scholar who is exploring an exciting part of Amarna period history. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Jackson, you can follow the links in the episode description to her personal website, her Twitter, and her YouTube channel. Now then, allow me to introduce Dr. Brianna Jackson. So hello, Brianna. Welcome to the History of Egypt podcast, and thank you for joining the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's really wonderful to join you.
That's great. How are things going? Where are you at the moment, and what's life like?
I'm in the Bronx, New York City. Okay. So we're still in kind of a quarantine here in New York, so there's not really much going on. And all of my family lives in the Chicago area, so it's just little me over here by myself. Yeah. That's okay.
So for those, you know, for my audience, you've done the amazing thing of completing your PhD dissertation in the middle of the lockdowns and everything that went on through 2020. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar, you literally just graduated. So congratulations.
Yes. And thank you so much.
I am excited to have you here while you're still fresh and riding on the adrenaline of your accomplishment, which is significant. So what was it like trying to finish a PhD in the middle of possibly the worst disruption that we could imagine in the modern world?
Yes, it was very difficult. And just trying to access resources alone was very challenging. And before lockdown happened in March of 2020, I went on this mad rush of trying to scan as many books as I possibly could within that last week. And luckily, there's a Facebook group where people are able to ask if anyone can share a PDF of an article, and that's very, very helpful. I mean, there were definitely some rough times for it, and I think everybody feels that way, you know, in terms of feeling very alone and cut off from others. So sometimes this kind of sets you back a little bit in terms of your progress, but and that happened with me, but I pushed through, and it was challenging, but also invigorating.
Okay. In what way?
Just trying to find that motivation and using different avenues of creativity to kind of motivate me. And so, I was doing a lot of creative stuff as a way to get me pumped up to continue my research.
Great. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit later, because you do have interesting creative outlets, which I think are really cool and exciting. So we'll do our best to get to those before the end of our time. I can only imagine, I mean, at the best of times, PhD research is a solitary, lonely experience. Throw in a global pandemic, and that must have been challenging. So I'm sure I speak for everyone when I say it's extremely impressive that you were able to complete it in Mabruk, you know.
Thank you.
So let's get to the meat of the topic then, basically. Broadly speaking, what was your PhD? What did you examine, and how would you sort of broadly summarize your research so far?
Well, that's why I gave a really simple title to my dissertation, and it's called The Geographic and Social Spread of Aten Cult Throughout Egypt and Sudan. And so basically I did just that. I looked at archaeological and textual data in all of the sites that I could find where there was the potential or a certitude of an Aten temple built at that site, or at the very least some activity relating to Aten worship. And I looked particularly at sites outside Amarna and Thebes. I do have a chapter about Amarna and Thebes, but I was really interested in the peripheral sites.
Mm, very good. And that's obviously a sort of, I don't want to say understudied, but perhaps underappreciated or underdocumented aspect of Akhenaten's religion and his socioeconomic policies is the many, many sites outside of the major centers. So, you know, it's easy for historians, and I include myself here, to focus on the large ones, the Karnak shrines and the ones at Amarna, because obviously those are the best preserved. We have the most information about those, which is a blessing and a curse, because it's great. We can talk about all the details of those, but they also tend to dominate the popular or general scholarship, and certainly the public awareness is those two sites. But as you say, art and worship and evidence for that appears in many places beyond those big cities. So very briefly, how many Aten temples do we know about and actually have physical or textual evidence for?
I did a little math last night about this, and I arranged, well, in my mind at least, the temples according to confirmed temples or chapels, because chapels are also part of it, and suggested temples or chapels. And so in terms of the confirmed temples, this is confirmed by texts stating this Aten temple in this place, and also actual existing temples, even if it's just the foundations, right? Mm. Suggested temples includes other stuff, and we can talk about that. But in terms of confirmed temples and chapels, and I'm including sunshade chapels in this, I'm not sure if your audience is familiar, but we can talk about that too. I counted 25 Aten temples. It's a lot.
So, I'll just clarify. I use temples broadly, but maybe what I should say is confirmed sites of worship of any size or shape. So 25, okay, that's a lot more than, you know, generally we would expect for any king, really, a single ruler to leave evidence for 25 religious institutions is quite significant. Mm-hmm. So getting a little bit more detailed there, do we know many of the names of these temples, or is there a gap? You know, what do we know about the identification of these sites?
Sure. Not all of them have names that have survived that we know of. And I should also mention that there were possibly two temples dedicated to the god Ra, and at least through year 5 of Akhenaten's reign, a temple dedicated to Ptah was still functioning. So there's even more than just the Aten temples themselves. But the names of the confirmed temples mostly were Per Aten, so the House of Aten. And these might also be considered enclosures, not necessarily temples, but the enclosure of the Aten precinct, perhaps. In Heliopolis, there was a temple called the Weches Ra, which is he lifts Ra in Heliopolis of Ra, which is the full name of the temple. I didn't want to give all of the Egyptian names. And then, of course, in Amarna, you have the Genpa Aten, you have the Hutpa Aten, you have the Ruat Anku Aten, you have the Kedef Aketen Aten. At Thebes, you have, again, the Genpa Aten, the Hut Benben, the Teni Menu, and the Ruat Menu. So I think those are the names. But yeah, some of these names are repeated for different temples. We have temples in Nubian sites as well, but we don't have names associated with these that survive.
Okay.
So there's that.
So if the temples are sharing names in some capacity, in some instances, how do you confirm which temple is being referenced? Do they have geographic markers, you know, the house of Aten in this place?
They do have geographic markers. In Charu, which is in Sinai, there was a Per Aten that was constructed there, and there are ceilings in the tomb of Tutankhamun saying the wine from the Per Aten of Charu. So we have instances of that.
Great.
In Memphis, there is a tomb for this gentleman named Mary Neith, who changed his name to Mary Ra during the reign of Akhenaten. And on his statue, it says that he is the scribe of the Per Aten in Akhet Aten and Memphis, which is quite interesting. And there's been some debate about that, whether it means that the temple is actually named Per Aten in Akhet Aten and then it's in Memphis, or if it means the Per Aten in Amarna and in Memphis. So there's been some debate about that. Okay. I subscribe to the letter.
And for those listening, we recently did a mini episode about Mary Neith / Mary Ra. So if you want to listen to that, it is available on the feed now. So broadly speaking, where do these Aten sanctuaries, enclosures, temples, where do they show up in a sort of broad geographic spread?
Sure. The confirmed temples, I'm just going to really state that it's the confirmed temples, are mostly in Delta. So we have Heliopolis and Memphis, and then you have Charu, which is near Tel El Borg, which has been excavated by an archaeologist named James Hoffmeyer. So there were some Aten temple blocks that were found at that site, and they probably came from Charu, which is quite nearby. And then obviously there's Amarna and Thebes, but then there are, in terms of confirmed sites, I'm counting, hold on. what is it? Four sites in Nubia? Three confirmed. So you have Jebel Barkal, you have Dokigel, and you have Sasibi, where there are confirmed Aten temples.
Okay, so basically they go from the border of the Sinai in the Delta, which is Charu and Tel El Borg, all the way upriver to the fourth cataract at Jebel Barkal.
Okay. Yes.
So broadly speaking, he commissioned these sanctuaries everywhere that was within his administrative domain.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess on a related note, because you've mentioned the sort of the titles and the individuals who are associated with these sanctuaries, what do we know about the administration of these temples, specifically the ones outside Amarna and Karnak? You know, what do we know about the people associated with them, and what were they doing?
That's quite challenging, especially for temples in Nubia, because there's not really data that explains what was going on there. And it would be interesting to know, because it was a geographical location that was governed by a viceroy and not the king himself, right? So he had his right hand was elsewhere. So it would be interesting to know how those would have been run. But for the temples in Memphis and Heliopolis, we know that there were overseers of cattle in these temples. There were overseers of the double granary, an overseer of a treasury. So you would find kind of traditional roles being played by the temple staff as you would have with the Amun temples. So I would say that the administrative aspect was probably quite similar or the same even as traditional temples.
That makes sense. Why reinvent that particular part of the wheel, I guess? So So from what we know about these temples, specifically the archaeological sites, you know, the ones that have survived in like the foundations, do these other sanctuaries show any unique features in their architecture or decoration? You know, we have a lot of information about the Aten sanctuaries at Karnak and Amarna in terms of their physical appearance. What do we know about these other ones?
The architectural remains are pretty standard in terms of using Talatet blocks. There are some interesting features of the Heliopolis temple or temples. For example, the Wetchis Ra temple that I had mentioned, there was this massive stela, which is now in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. It's huge, and it shows Akhenaten and Nefertiti worshipping the Aten, of course, and it also shows their daughter Meket Aten, but only Meket Aten, not Merit Aten, which is very interesting. So that's quite unique. You would think that it would be both of the two oldest daughters, but it was only Meket Aten who was the second.
Interesting.
Yeah. And in 2019, there was a block that was found, and it's definitely Akhenaten, but it's before the switch to his new art form, and he's depicted as a recumbent sphinx, and it's so fascinating. Mostly you will find blocks made with limestone, but sometimes there are some architectural features where quartzite was used. For example, the sunshade of Merit Aten that was found, a block of which was found in Heliopolis. At a possible temple at Akhmim, there are these very enormous, enormous blocks that have Atenist imagery on them, iconography. And so, of course, the usual argument is that any of the architecture found outside Amarna and Thebes was brought there later. But for these blocks in Akhmim, it seems a little much to bring such an enormous block. Let me think of a size of a desk. Yeah, it would be unusual to bring that. And so, I mean, there are those aspects as well, the size of blocks.
Interesting.
But mostly it's pretty standard, especially with the text formulae that give the name of a temple and its epithet. And so that tends to be pretty standard throughout the architecture.
Okay. In the big picture then, so we have temples, you know, ranging from the north to the very southern limits of Akhenaten's kingdom. What do we know about how these temples, including the major centers, sort of connected together in administrative or economic terms? You know, are there any sort of observable features of the archaeology or the texts that give a sense of how they connect together?
Well, that's one of my more original ideas in my dissertation. I bring up a concept of a network of temples. So my idea is that the temples that share names, so let's say you have a temple by one name in, let me use the Per Wa'enre, the house of Wa'enre, as an example. So there's a sunshade chapel of Merit Aten that is believed to have been built at Heliopolis. That's where one of the blocks was found, and Joseph Wegner wrote an incredible monograph on it. And it says that this is the sunshade of Merit Aten in the house of Wa'enre in Akhet Aten. Meanwhile, Amarna, in Akhet Aten, in the tomb of one of the officials, it refers to a house of Wa'enre in Heliopolis. And so there's this, my idea is if there was a house of Wanre in Amarna and a house of Wanre in Heliopolis, my idea was that perhaps whatever temple income or chapel income or whatever income was coming into the outlying temple, that part of this was sent as a tax to the equally named temple at Amarna. Okay. It's very complex setup there. But and I think that because in sites like Abydos, mm-hmm. Where I argue that there was at least one Aten chapel that mm-hmm. was built there. So the chapels that are there, I suggest maybe there are two or at least one. But the names of those temples or chapels are different from what you would find in Heliopolis. So another idea that I had was at these sites, there was a very particular aspect of the cult that was practiced, and it wasn't always the same ritual at this place versus that place. So that was, those were my, in a nutshell, that was my idea.
Obviously, it's a complex thing that literally takes an entire dissertation to explain. So
yes.
Yeah, fair enough. So if I've understood you correctly, so we have evidence for sanctuaries in multiple cities, say Memphis in the north and Amarna in the middle, and they share yes. the same name. And yes. your hypothesis or your proposed explanation is that the temples that have the same name are essentially kind of like sister sites, and they're connected to each other and possibly sharing resources either both directions, or the one outside the capital is sending resources to the capital.
And exactly, then, yeah, you said it better than I did.
And then and then in the religious sense, that maybe these specific types of temples or sanctuaries with specific names maybe relate to different aspects of the Aten worship and what is required.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So that's interesting, because, you know, as I guess you can probably help with this, the sort of general idea of Akhenaten's religious organization is that he's the central figure, that he's the sole intermediary between humans and Ra. You know, he's literally Wa in Ra.
Mm.
But perhaps if there are, I guess, if there's multiple temples, you know, there's always that practical thing of he can't be at every temple providing the offerings, but Aten still needs all of his offerings. So would these different aspects of the religious rituals perhaps be a way around that essential conundrum, or just, you know, other people are taking care of certain different aspects while he, the king, is focusing on the core relationship with the god?
Well, yeah, you definitely said it. To use Heliopolis as another example, there is an administrator by the name of Mai who worked there. He was buried in Amarna, so he was taking care of business in Heliopolis, but he was still associated with Amarna. And to bring up the Nubian sites again, this was all covered by the viceroy. So I think that there definitely had to have been people working at these temples or chapels or sanctuaries all the time. And I think that because somebody had made an argument, there was a scholar that made an argument about Mary Neith, Mary Ray, who, when the capital switched to Amarna, that he moved there and didn't work in Memphis anymore. And then after the reign of Akhenaten, he moved back to Memphis. But the text on his statue suggests that he still worked in Memphis and he was taking care of business at the Aten temple there. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there was definitely various people and local people taking care of the cult at these different sites.
Sure. We will return with more of my interview with Dr. Brianna Jackson after the break. In chapter 2, we continue our discussion of Akhenaten's temples and religion and try to get a sense of how this all fits together with our view of the king himself. Then we will talk about Brianna's research and her interests and her extracurricular activities, which dovetail quite nicely with Egyptology as a science. That is chapter 2 after the break. See you in a moment.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
And now, part 2 of my conversation with Dr. Brianna Jackson. We have discussed the details about Aten's sanctuaries throughout Egypt and Nubia. Now, it is time to look at them in the big picture. How does this all fit together, and what does it tell us about Akhenaten? We've sort of covered the little aspects of this here and there. So summing up, I guess, what's your idea of how these other temples fit into the larger picture of Akhenaten's reign? You know, what do these other sanctuaries tell us about his beliefs, his priorities, or the way he expressed his ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if you consider this part of an answer to this question, but one thing that I mention in my dissertation is that the move to Amarna wasn't just to control the entire population, but it was to create a cult city just for the Aten itself, just for that god, in order to make the religion mature, because you have Osiris, he has his own cult site, Amun has his own cult site. So the Aten, to be a mature god, would need its own cult site. And I think that was possibly one of the reasons why the new capital city was founded. And another one of my suggestions in my dissertation is that it was very interesting to me to see that Aten sanctuaries, to use your term, were set up in cities or sites that were dedicated to creator or regenerative gods. And I thought that this was interesting because the Aten itself is a creator god. And so my theory is that these sanctuaries were constructed at these sites in order to incorporate the creative and regenerative properties of the other gods into the religion. In Abydos, there is evidence that there was still Osiris cult being practiced during the Amarna period. And so, I mean, it wasn't just to spread the religion to all of these sites, but I think it was also meant to incorporate the creative energies of these other gods. And in the Nubian sites, it would make sense for him to establish Aten cults there because it was mostly Amun who was worshipped, if only Amun. And one of the things I argue is that it would undermine his authority to allow in one of the outlying regions of his empire. It would undermine him to have an Amun cult still practiced. And so I think that there is some kind of imperialistic nature, at least as far as the Nubian sites are concerned. Was he crazily, obsessively forcing people to worship? I don't think so, because there's a lot of evidence, like what Anna Stevens has published, that so many, even at Amarna, traditional religion was still practiced. So I think, yeah, there's a sense of imperialism as far as the Nubian sites are concerned, but within Egypt, I think it was to incorporate people and the creator gods together to create this widespread religion, I think that people willingly across Egypt practiced it, and they weren't just forced to do so at Amarna. I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, it does. It's all sort of, and it so the Aten temples or the sanctuaries, particularly the ones outside of Karnak and Amarna, they add sort of nuances to the overall picture of Akhenaten's place in the world. You know, his the role of the pharaoh within the cosmos and his relationship to the gods, and they sort of they've led you to a hypothesis that many of the symbols or the ideas that he's promoting are political in nature in a broader sense.
I mean, if you include Nubia into that, I would say yes. But there, I think that there was also a strong theological component, at least within the Egyptian the Egyptian sites where these temples would have been built.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay. So that brings me to the end of my questions about Amarna. So as you know, as anyone can see, it's a very large and complex aspect of Egyptian history, and there's their sociological development. How do you feel about the period now that you've finished your research or your long project? How do you feel about it?
Well, I was my advisor and my committee are anxious for me to publish it. They really want it to be published. So that's definitely what I'm thinking about now. When I started studying the Amarna period, I had a completely different view of the period. It was more of a sensationalist view. And then as I continued to research, I was finding things that make that seem like the religion is even more traditional than I had anticipated. And so it's been a journey for me to learn about this. And I don't think that we're ever going to know 100% about what this religion was about and how it was practiced. And so it's always going to include a lot of speculation. But at the same time, I'm hoping that I can slowly be proved right.
Yeah,
about everything. All want that.
we'll bring you back in 10 years and see how you feel then. No, that's interesting, especially the traditional undercurrents of Akhenaten's religion. You know, that's definitely a sort of a major new horizon for historical investigation, is how much of his religion really is just a rephrasing of older ideas.
Exactly.
Yeah, as you say, we'll never know the full truth. Arguably, the only person who knew the full truth was him, and it died with him. And if there's one thing we get from history, is that even he may not have fully understood the nuances of what he was aiming for.
Yeah. You know, you're absolutely right about that. That's such a good point, because his religion was constantly developing. The name of the Aten was developing, at least until year 12. I think he didn't really know what he wanted. That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Because there's definitely that debate amongst sort of theological historians, is did Akhenaten make it up as he went, or did he have a master plan that he gradually implemented? I tend to think that for the most part, he made it up as he went. Made it up, but his ideas developed over time. You know,
exactly, yeah.
Because depending how we look at it, when he came to the throne, he was a relatively young man. His ideas, he may have been passionate, fanatical, but his ideas would still naturally develop as he grows and learns. So,
and the same with the art. If you look at Aswan, the rock cut stela of Bek, that shows how Akhenaten told him, "I want you to depict me this way," So he did. And then over time, the art softens. And you kind of have to wonder if he had his advisors kind of helping him develop, you know, putting forth their ideas. And then, I mean, maybe it was a group effort.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of that will have to rely on how old we think he was, because, you know, scholars like Mark Gabold, following the 2010 study, think KV55 was Akhenaten. Maybe he was actually a child when he came to power, which personally I find very hard to swallow, especially with how quickly the princesses show up.
Yeah.
But the more specific aspect of that is, you know, how was Akhenaten 19 or 14? You know, what is the actual, who was in control, you know, who was leading him, who was guiding him? Because, yeah, as always, the public image is of a totalitarian, all-powerful ruler, but behind the scenes, we just don't know how much was actually negotiated. So,
right.
This all adds to our picture of him. So, okay, great. And now part three of the conversation, in which we discuss Brianna's career, her interests, and her extracurricular activities that overlap with historical research. So coming now, let's talk about you. So, you know, what inspired you to pursue ancient Egypt as your research specialty, and, you know, what you wanted to do?
Well, you hear most Egyptologists say that they wanted to be an Egyptologist since they were a kid. I didn't. I wanted to be everything else, basically. I had so many plans. And it was actually my sister who wanted to be an Egyptologist, funnily enough. I didn't decide to go into Egyptology until October of 2008. I was originally going to be a veterinarian, and that's what I applied to university for. And when I got to university right away, I decided I would go into French instead of biology or animal science. And the whole time I was... quite a switch, yeah. And so I was taking courses in ancient everything throughout this whole time, because I was kind of interested in it. And most of what was available at my university was just Greece and Rome. And I was kind of slowly not enjoying the French major, because we were reading too much contemporary literature that I didn't like. I like old stuff. So I took this course with the scholar who would eventually be my advisor in undergrad, Nanome Renatos. She was teaching a course on ancient Near Eastern and Egyptian literature. And so I was taking this course, and it just, when we were reading about Akhenaten, that was the moment when I realized, this is what I want to do. And so I switched my major again to classics, because that was what was available. And so I got my degree in classics, and then I applied to some schools for graduate school. I got into the master's program at NYU at the Institute of Fine Arts, and then I applied for PhD programs and got into the PhD program at NYU, and my advisor is David O'Connor. So I was very lucky to have David O'Connor as my advisor.
Definitely. So you really took the scenic path before you got here. But,
yes,
you know, that brings its own benefits, because now you have experience and knowledge and things that can only add to your research. So that's good. Mm-hmm. So you've participated in field work and excavation, and, you know, you've spent time in Egypt for your research. Just out of curiosity, you know, what are your most treasured memories or experiences that you've had so far?
There's a lot. That's a list. The first time I went to Egypt was in 2013. And I remember I stepped out of the airport and I was like, this is unlike any place I have ever been. And so that was really interesting, just seeing a brand new culture. And I remember the the first time I read hieroglyphs on site, it was the name Osiris on this fragment of a statue in Abydos, and that's where I've been working. So my fondest memories are not actually involved in excavation or actual work in Egypt, but my adventures of doing my dissertation research in Egypt. I have some really wonderful Egyptian friends, and they set me up with some really great experiences. And one of them, I had lunch, they were tameya sandwiches and tea inside the pillared hall of Mary Ray's tomb. That was so cool. I'm sitting there eating a sandwich inside his tomb. I'm like, really? Actually, it's kind of like what ancient Egyptians did, right? When they would have their picnics during the beautiful festival of the valley.
That's lovely. That's a really good memory. And I guess it emphasizes that point that for many of us, we come to Egypt because we love the history and the monuments. But what really brings most of us back is the people that we meet and the experiences we have with them. You know, theoretically we can study all of this from a library, but it's the people in Egypt who really make it what it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's nothing great. Beats it, in my opinion. Yeah.
I am very envious of that lunch. That sounds great. Okay. So this is my next question is one that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and I get the full gamut of answers. So we sort of learn a little bit about people from this. And the question is that if you could answer with 100% certainty, like definitive confirmation, if you could answer one question or solve one problem from Egyptian history, what would you choose to know and why?
I think this is probably a silly answer, but I do wonder constantly, why didn't Akhenaten send Tushratta the statues that he was constantly asking for? I want to know. He said Tushratta contacts his mother to say, can you please tell your son to send me these statues? And he still doesn't do it. Why? I would love to know that. I mean, it's such a simple thing. Tushratta's right. Gold is plentiful. What's the problem? He's absolutely right. I want to know.
Yeah, why didn't he send them? Because if he was melting down all the other divine statues, he must have had plenty of gold. But is he spending it all at Amarna?
Maybe.
Why didn't he? Was he just cheap? It does sound like Akhenaten had a slightly impolite relationship with the great kings. Like there's the one where Sibililiumar complains that Akhenaten hasn't addressed him in the proper status.
He was just a brat then.
Yeah, why was he just, you know, egotistical? Had he just really drunk the Kool-Aid in terms of how great the pharaoh was or whatever? Okay, so why didn't he send the golden statues? That is a good question. Because he sent gold, gilded wood, didn't he? He didn't.
Yes, he didn't. Yes. Okay. Trying to be very sneaky. Didn't work.
Okay. So that's fantastic. That's a good answer. I like that. It's both very specific, but it does tell you a lot about the curious questions that we can go with in history. Okay, so let's move now to a question on the more sort of, I guess, sidetrack or the personal interests. And I noticed when I was going through your website that along with your academic research, you've also released a guide to the video game Abduction. And, you know, for those listening who are unfamiliar, Abduction is an exploration and puzzle solving game. And it's produced by the studio who made Myst and its sequels, which were incredibly popular computer games in the 1990s and early 2000s. I grew up playing Myst when I was young, so that was quite an interesting thing to stumble across. So you know, that it might sound strange that you're doing this research and then you're also producing a exploration puzzle guide for a very specific niche video game. But it does kind of make sense because, you know, history and archaeology shares many similarities in terms of exploration, clue gathering, puzzle solving. So what I'm most curious at is that has your experience with those kind of games impacted your historical research or vice versa?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just have to say I am so excited that you've played Myst. So many people haven't even heard of it. And I'm like, ah! The whole Myst series has been very impactful on my life. And I know that sounds really bizarre. But for other people listening, I'm sure they will think that it's weird. But I think you understand. But the first time I was 11 years old when I played Riven, and that was the first of the games that I played. I didn't play Myst first. I played Riven, and it was a gift from my brother in Christmas of 97. And we didn't play, my sisters and I didn't play until 1998. And yeah, it's very impactful. And I'm sure you can reminisce also about just being in the room and maybe your family's around or you're watching a sibling or a cousin or whoever and they're playing or they're watching you and it's like this, it's just, it is not an experience that you can have anymore in this day and age, I don't think. It was a completely unique experience. And I still remember the first image that I saw of Riven, and I have a poster of it on my wall. But I mean, that was the game that really got me interested in games in general. And the first game about Egypt that I played was in 2004, and that was Pharaoh.
Of course.
Which is a city building game. Yeah. And I still love it to this day.
That's for our generation, that is a ritual of passage that you play a lot of Pharaoh. And then later you come back to it and you realize, wait, the economy in this game does not match up, but it's part of the way you should work.
I still love it. They're actually remastering it. An indie group is working on remastering it, which is great. Yeah. but with Abduction, because I'm such a diehard fan of the whole Cyan Company and because they've done so much for me indirectly, just with the games that, you know, I definitely wanted to support them on their Kickstarter in 2013 when they announced that they were making the game, and it came out in 2016. And that was when I was just starting to work on my dissertation proposal. My advisor retired at that time as well, so that caused a lot of complications in terms of getting things done in a timely manner, which is totally, I don't blame anybody or whatever. It's just how things work. And then of course my ceiling collapsed as well because of a flood on the third floor. It was very stressful times. And so this, the game was a way for me to, it's kind of like what was going on during the pandemic. I was able to channel my stress into a creative way. And with all of the, it was just a way for me to manage the stress I was under, and I created this game guide. And it just started off with, because you have to draw diagrams, you know, you've played Myst, so you have to draw things, you have to write down all of the clues so you remember. And so it just started with drawing diagrams, and then it turned into this whole thing where I just made this guide just to get through rough situations. And I showed fellow fans, and they said, you have to contact Cyan and ask if you can publish us. So I did. And they said, yeah, go for it. And then they worked with me to make sure that it was the best thing ever. They sent me their logo, and I was like, oh my God, 11-year-old me was screaming. you know, just playing these games definitely got me into other video games. And oh my goodness, I forgot where I was going with this.
Whether it's impacted your historical research skills or vice versa.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay, sorry about that.
That's fine. If anyone's familiar with Myst, long-winded answers are par for the course.
I met Rand Miller, by the way. No way. I was so tall. Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. I was so nervous. I don't even know what I said. It was completely blacked out. But anyway, it's a hero. But with Pharaoh, one thing, this was, oh gosh, whoa, and back in 2015, I had this idea to use Pharaoh as a teaching tool for students who were learning about ancient Egypt and about the development of the state. And you know, I had this, I thought it was a brilliant idea. Nobody was on board. And of course, everybody's on board these days, which was really frustrating for me when I found out. And so, yeah, I just thought it would be a really interesting learning tool. And that, I mean, and I do appreciate that that has come out a lot. And with that in mind, that was one of the reasons why I started on my YouTube channel to do let's plays of video games or computer games about ancient Egypt. And then, of course, it became popular in the main in other areas of Egyptology, and I was frustrated because I was like, I came up with it first. So I mean, yeah, I think that it has indirectly had an impact on me in a very long road, and it's kind of it's hard to map that out, but I think that, yeah, there, I mean, if over time it has had some kind of an impact on me, and how I think that these games could be useful in education. So there's that aspect. I hope that answers the question in a reasonable way.
Yeah, it does. Okay. Well, I mean, obviously right now it's kind of a very growth or popular growth area for academic outreach, but you know, like, yes, a lot of younger people, you know, they played something like Assassin's Creed Origins, and that really opened their eyes to the beauty of the actual world of ancient Egypt, of None of this sort of Hollywood, you know, the mummy style fantasy grandeur, but a game that was based more in, here's what, as far as we can model, the world might have looked like. And people really responded to that. And, you know, it's one of my favorite things about that game is I don't actually care about the story, but I just love wandering around and exploring. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they really set the bar. They really did.
It is. It's a really good game, and I would love to see sort of, you know, more indie attempt takes at that. It definitely seems like at the moment, games based in Egypt are sort of stuck between action fighting games or city builders, and there's got to be more in there. There's so much opportunity there for sort of holistic teaching tools kind of thing. So, all right, very last question, and this is not about video games, but before your PhD, you also did a master's, and within that, you researched the Amarna letters, or at least a specific aspect of the Amarna letters. And correct me if I've misunderstood this, but it seemed like you studied the correspondence between Egypt and the kingdom of Mitanni, and you particularly focused on references to solar iconography and ideas. So tell us a little bit about that research and, you know, what it sort of resulted.
Sure. The letters from Tushratta were a major part of it, but also I was looking at the so-called international style of art. And so I was looking at Mitannian art as well, like the palace at Nuri, where you have Hathorizing cow heads with rosettes above them. And it's very interesting. I wish there was more evidence of their palaces and other art. But I was looking at shared iconography, and I was also considering, for example, when Giluhepa was married off to Amenhotep III, and she brought with her almost 400 people, and I was thinking about how people from this completely different country, to use that term, I hate to use country, but for lack of a better term, that region, there you go, how about we say that, or that kingdom. They're bringing their own religion, their own culture to Egypt, and so there's going to be a mix with that as well. And so when I noticed how they have a lot of, even with the way things are described in the Amarna letters, in the the inventories of all of the gifts, right. I went through them and I saw everything that had some kind of solar iconography, and they have things like winged sun disks. On one of the letters from the Mitanni kingdom, there is a stamp, there's a cylinder seal impression of the sun god, the goddess. I think it was Shaushka who is depicted on one of the tablets. I was looking at the descriptions of solar iconography and then other instances where actual solar iconography was sent to Egypt. And also the other thing that I noticed was that they would greet each other's gods, or at least from the letters from Tushratta indicated that they would greet each other's gods. So he would say hello to Amun, and then he would say, you know, our sun god says hello. And then there were two instances where his father sent Amenhotep III, a statue of the goddess Shaushka, to go visit him. And a lot of scholars have missed the fact that this goddess was sent twice. And the common interpretation is that she was supposed to make Amenhotep III feel better. But I think that it was that she was being sent there to witness the said festival of Amenhotep III. And the fact that she was sent twice within a certain amount of time, a short period of time, I think that she was, I think she was sent for both said festivals. Maybe she would have been sent again. And so, I mean, this is a solar goddess, and just, I just think that it was really interesting that they had a lot of these shared solar beliefs. And I was arguing in the thesis that this was a way for them, it was one method of many to build a diplomacy, kind of to say, we have similar ideas. Maybe we have different names for them, but we understand each other because we have these same religious ideas, for example. So that was the gist.
That's interesting, because that reminds me very strongly of the festival where Hathor or Hathor comes forth to visit Horus of Edfu. And you mentioned the Hathoric heads in Nutsi or Nuri, and so you could almost see it from like a symbolic sort of family relationship building perspective. You know, the great kings are brothers, so our gods will be siblings as well.
Exactly. And the kingdom of Mitanni was very, 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 very close to the Egyptian kings Amenhotep III and Akhenaten, because Tushratta's sister and daughter were both married to Amenhotep III, and presumably his daughter, at least, was married to Akhenaten, or I say that he, quote unquote, inherited her, which is a really nasty thing to say, but I think that it's actually the word for it. He was Akhenaten's father-in-law, and he was Amenhotep III's brother-in-law. So, I mean, very close family ties, and it makes sense for them to also feel a familial relationship in terms of the religion.
That sounds very interesting. Do you have any plans to sort of pursue that research further?
That would be a good thing, I think. Unfortunately, I have absolutely no files of my master's thesis because one of my cats dumped tea on my laptop, and before I could transfer my files, the computer died, and she's sitting right next to me.
Ouch.
So I would be starting from scratch, which is probably a good thing anyway, because, you know, my skills, I think, have improved, or at least I should hope they have, since my master's thesis that I finished 8 years ago. So,
fair enough. Well, I hope you consider pursuing that, because it does sound like a really interesting angle of discussion.
Thank you.
So, Brianna, that brings me to the end of my all my questions. So thank you very much for coming on the History of Egypt podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
Great. I hope you've enjoyed yourself, and I hope you'll consider coming on again in the future to discuss whatever you work on next.
Thank you so much.
That brings us to the end of this interview. My special thanks to Dr. Jackson for agreeing to speak with the podcast, and I hope you have enjoyed this conversation. That's all from me. I'll see you soon. Take care, and may the Aten shine upon your house. The music for this episode was by Michael Levy, his song Awe of the Aten, and little interludes were provided by Keith Zizza and Luke Chaos. Follow the links in the episode description to learn more about these wonderful musicians. They have generously shared their songs with me, and I am very grateful. Please consider supporting them. Follow the links to learn more about their music.
As a long-time foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.